Good evening. This is an interview for the Michigan Writer Series, Friday, February 27th, 2004. Tonight I'm speaking with Jerry LaFemina, an MFA graduate of Western Michigan University, the founding editor of the literary journal Controlled Burn, and the current distinguished poet in residence at Frostburg State University in Maryland. Welcome to the MSU Libraries, Jerry.
Well, thank you, Stephanie.
So you're rather incredulous about being a distinguished anything. So how's it going for you at Frostburg?
It's a great adjective. I sort of try to milk it for all it's worth. You know, I put my feet up on my desk and say I'm just being distinguished. Frostburg is treating me very, very well.
Good.
And the idea, I would never have thought I would have that adjective associated with me. Extinguished, definitely. Distinguished was a surprise.
Is that just for the spring semester?
Just for the spring semester.
And then where do you think you'll head?
I might end up back at Grand Valley, where I was last fall. But there are other possibilities out there that I don't feel comfortable talking about just now.
Well, that's fine. Now, what took a New York City native to the wilds of northern Michigan, or Grayling, for a few years?
9 years.
Nine years
in northern Michigan, which I like to say was just like New York without the subways. And what's Grayling? It's a population of 1,100. Mm-hmm. And the greater New York metropolitan area has a population of 11 million. So that's like 0.1% or something.
Mm-hmm.
We'll work for food.
Okay.
I graduated from Western with an MFA and an MA in May of 1993. The Irvin Gilmore Emerging Artists Foundation had given me a grant to write for the summer, which I did. And then I was teaching some adjunct and working as a temp and trying to pay the bills and raise a son who was about a year and a half old at that time. And it was not working. The, mm-hmm. the math just, there was a lot of red ink. And I applied for a job at Kirtland and got it, which was incredulous to me at the time. And stayed there for 9 years. They were very good to me, very generous to me, but it was also time to go.
And that's
what happened.
What led you to establish what I believe is the nation's first Associate of Arts in Creative Writing?
Associate in Fine Arts.
Fine Arts, thanks.
There are Associate of Arts degrees. The Studio Arts program at Kirtland wanted to give their students recognition for what they did, and we were working with them and saw it as a way of recognizing the creative endeavor. Kirtland has a sort of strange situation because it's in the middle of nowhere. The nearest bookstore is in Traverse City from Kirtland.
Mm-hmm.
So the place where any sort of art happened, north of Mount Pleasant, really, outside of Traverse City, was Kirtland. I mean, mm-hmm. art gallery, library with literature in it, all those things are happening at Kirtland. And so we decided to, with the blessings of the dean, Richard Silverman, really recognize the artistic endeavors of the community members that were coming to the school.
So
they developed an Associate in Fine Arts degree in creative writing, in studio arts, and in theater.
Cool. Now, as I was reading through your work, and granted it was a lot of your older work, I noticed that a lot of your poems are about adolescence, even if looking back fondly or not so fondly on the lust and longing of the teenage years. And I was just wondering if you have unresolved issues from that age that prompts you to write so much about it.
I still eat like I'm 16. I once heard that you're either a poet of childhood or a poet of adolescence.
Mm.
I don't know if that's necessarily true, but I'll use it as a cop-out right now and say I'm the latter.
Yeah.
No, I think that that adolescence is a really wonderful nexus of things. You feel invulnerable, but you know you're not.
Mm-hmm.
And that creates a certain tension. You feel like you know it all,
mm-hmm.
but you know you don't. you're experimenting with things that you sort of know you shouldn't be experimenting with, but the consequences don't seem anyway that great. And so there's a lot of energy, I think, that comes in adolescence, sociological, psychological energy. And also, I think most of the significant transformations, realizations, spiritual, emotional, psychological, physiological, all happened at that time. And now that I have a son who's 12, I see those things happening in him. And so I think what I try to do is write a sort of survival manual. I work at the Control Burn Seminar for Young Writers. I love working with 15 to 20-year-olds. Mm-hmm. I had a friend die of a heroin overdose when I was 15. I was at the party where this event happened. And I like to see that poetry then can be a way of survival.
And your friend who died, I was wondering that, Eddie?
No, that was a student of mine.
Or just a student.
That was a student of mine. And again, that's a real sort of way of saying, Eddie Warman was a student of mine who killed himself.
Oh.
And I always felt like I missed something, and of course I didn't. There was nothing really to miss, but his classmates ended up just a parade of them over the rest of the semester to my office to talk. And so I like to think that some of what I try to do in poetry is create a survival guide for adolescents, which I think is rough water sometimes.
Do you ever fear veering into sentimentality?
I think every poem risks sentimentality if it's really good. But there's the fine line, and I'm a brutal editor to my students, and I'm an even more brutal editor to myself. Most poems go through about 70 to 80 drafts for me.
Wow.
Now, a draft might be I took a comma out, and then the next draft might be I put the comma back in. But I'm pretty brutal. I don't let myself get away with much crap at this point.
Okay. Well, please tell me about your two new collections, long delayed but just published, Graffiti Heart, and the forthcoming Bodeguera Prize winner, The Parakeets of Brooklyn.
Oh, there's one in between the two.
Oh, there is.
Graffiti Heart's a much older book. It was supposed to come out in 2000, and the press folded. And then there was talk about another press wanting it, but that didn't happen. And I finally sent it to the Anthony Piccione Prize at Mammoth Books, and surprise, it won. And then it was supposed to come out last March, and the publisher took ill with a flesh-eating virus. I don't know how you get a flesh-eating virus in America in 2003, but you do. And so the book just came out in the end of 2003, and it was first printed in edition with graffiti spelled wrong on the cover.
Mm-hmm.
And so the book was delayed yet again, and at this point I thought the UPS man delivering them to me was going to get hijacked or be in an accident. But the book's out, and it's I'm very pleased with how it looks, but the poems... to me, because the book was really finished in 2000, seemed quite old. There's a book coming out next month on New Issues Press from Kalamazoo called The Window Facing Winter.
Oh, that's right.
Which I've seen the galley pages and seen the cover.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't expecting to have another book come out after that for a while. I was but I was convinced to send 10 pages of poetry to the Bordighera Prize, which is all they require, 10 pages, and I had 10 mm-hmm. pages, and I forgot I did it, and when they called me up and told me I'd won, I was sort of flabbergasted because I didn't know what she was talking about when she called. But then I had to actually put a manuscript together.
I was just going to ask, did you have to hustle?
A lot of poems that I could put together,
mm-hmm.
Fortunately, because the book is translated into Italian, it didn't have to be 70 pages of poetry.
Okay.
It only had to be about 45, and that was easier. I tend to write a longer poem mm-hmm. anyway, and so it was easier to put something like that together, and I've just seen some of the Italian translations, which I have no clue what they say, but when I read them out loud, knowing how to pronounce the words anyway, they sound great, and the translator in Italy is wonderful, and in a couple of weeks, I'll be in New York for the big Bordighera Prize party that they have, and they'll read the translations, and we'll drink lots of Zambuca and eat cannolis, and
Well, that sounds good.
Sounds like a great time.
Yeah. Well, speaking of translations, you were involved in translating the works of a Turkish poet. How did you get involved with that?
When I got to Kirtland, the professor of political science at Kirtland is a native-born Turk.
Okay.
And he and I became fast friends, and part of it was his love for poetry. And in one of those strange sort of coincidences, I was terrible at languages in school, and so I took linguistics. And where I went to school for the linguistics class, we had to live for several months with a family that spoke a different language. Mm-hmm. That was a requirement, and write a grammar of that language, and I ended up living with a Turkish family. And so in one of those really strange coincidences, Sinan and I, so here's this guy who's Turkish who loves poetry and has all these books of in Turkish of poetry, and here's the only language I have any real skill with at all. Not so much as I remember the language, I don't, but I remembered the music of the language and the sound of the language. And so he and I got involved in doing Voice Lock Puppet, and he picked the hardest poet I could think of to pick. These poems are very intensely lyric, but they are also surrealist in nature and very political. And I write a much longer, meditative, realistic poem, and so it was a stretch.
Yeah.
It was a great experience. It took us 7 years to do a book's worth of poems. I mean, we had more, but they weren't all that good. And very happy with it. And the process I would get a word for word literal translation with no pronouns, no articles, and a tape of Sinan reading it in Turkish and a copy of the Turkish, and then I would go from there and work on. And if there was slang or double meanings, all those things that you don't get, it would all be noted, and then I would have to make it palatable to an American audience, which was sometimes more difficult than others.
Are you interested in ever attempting something like that again?
Sinan and I have talked about it. I also spoke with a good friend of mine about doing translations of Mayakovsky's love poems from the Russian, but that has really stalled. I did some work with a Burmese fellow I know, but it didn't have the same sort of shimmer, so that fell through. I'm considering talking to the woman who's translating Parakeets of Brooklyn into English about translating her book of poems from the Italian with her.
Oh,
I think
okay.
that would be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And Sinan and I still talk about possible options of who to do next in, from Turkish. But right now, I've just had so much of my own work to do. I just finished the second draft of a novel.
Oh, wow.
And have a manuscript of stories under consideration. So I've been working on a lot of other projects, as well as my own poems. So need just some time away from that. It really requires giving up a lot of your aesthetic and a lot of your voice. And I've been involved in other projects that have taken me out of that voice, too.
Right.
So,
well, speaking of those other projects, later this year, Mammoth Books is going to publish the anthology Poetry 30-something American Poets. Now, you're one of the two co-editors of that volume, and who came up with the idea for this work?
The poet Sean Thomas Dougherty and I talked many years ago about doing a young poets anthology. And we sort of batted the idea around a number of times, and then several such anthologies came out. The most notably American Poetry, The Next Generation, on Carnegie Mellon University Press, which Jim Daniels and Jerry Costanzo edited. And so we sort of put that on the back burner. And but as I use these anthologies in classes, I started to wish for something different, something that had less poets and more poems by each poet, and something that had a greater breadth of the aesthetic spectrum that poets of my generation are writing. And so I spoke to Dan Crocker about doing this, and he said, well, if you do most of the work, I'm in. which was fine, and my goal was to really present 8 pages of poetry by each poet, rather than the 2 or 3 that were often happening, but also to sort of open it up and not try, you know, I could easily have picked 30 friends of mine or 30 people I knew, and I actually rejected many friends of mine.
Oh, I bet that was hard.
It was hard. Several of my friends decided not to submit, which took the pressure off of me, one fellow actually sent me an email and said, just recently, and said, I couldn't talk to you for a while. I was really upset. Yeah. And I don't blame him, but he also knows the sort of realities of the business, which is I didn't want, you know, 6 poets from Brooklyn that sounded similarly. I mean, it wouldn't fulfill what I wanted the mission of this anthology to be. Mm-hmm. And so... But in the process of all this, we came up with this great cover design, which is going to be a hockey jersey, which is going to say poetry as the name, and then the number is going to be 30. And then Mammoth Books is actually going to make Poetry 30 hockey jerseys with a big Mammoth logo on the front.
Good marketing tool.
A great marketing tool, and I'm excited about it as a big hockey fan, too. So.
Cool. This being the Michigan Writer Series, we always try to ask our guests about Michigan and the impact living and working here has on their writing and so forth, but try to put it within the context of their work. So I pay special attention to poems you wrote about the Great Lakes, in part, and that you seem to almost have a mystical reverence for them. Like, there's a poem about Lake Superior and, like, looking over and imagining the other side of the lake to be another world altogether. So what... ultimately has living and working here contributed to your writing?
Well, when it comes to looking across Lake Superior, there is another world. It's Canada, and it's it's a whole other planet sometimes. Michigan has been... I lived in Michigan for 1/3 of my life. Mm-hmm. And if you think that the first third of my life, just about, I don't really remember it. So Michigan, my son was born and raised in Michigan. Mm-hmm. My adulthood was in Michigan, and there are a lot of Michigan poems, particularly in The Window Facing Winter, which is, when you live in Grayling, it's easy to see that this is the only direction your window faces. Yes. But one of the things that Michigan gave me was a sense of the natural world. When you grow up in Brooklyn and Staten Island and the Lower East Side of Manhattan, you know a lot about people and about the smell of Ethiopian food at night, and you know, you learn how to count the junkies, but you don't know the names of flowers. You don't see much wildlife. So the Great Lakes, for me particularly, but also the Ossabal River, which shows up in a lot of poems. These are clean bodies of water. I mean, my bodies of water were the East River and the Hudson River south of the Bronx. These were not clean bodies of water. You know, and so And there's a lot of snow in my poems, and there's a lot of snow in my poems because of Grayling.
Yes.
My first book is called 23 Below, and the title of that came from a morning in which I had been at Kirtland for about 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. And it was 23 below, and I ran out to the garage and started the car and ran back in and thinking, I didn't know it got this cold south of, you know, the Arctic Circle.
Right.
And inevitably drove to school, and school was canceled because it was too cold. But nobody had told me. I wasn't on anybody's call list or anything. So so there's a lot of winter, a lot of rivers, but also a lot of animals. I have poems called Raccoon and Coyote. I saw a fox once. I've seen a Kirtland's warbler.
Yeah.
I have a poem called Skunk Cologne and The Window Facing Winter. And so I remember Judith Minty once saying, what's your totem animal? Mm-hmm. And for her, it's the bear, of course. Mm-hmm. And I hate to admit my totem animal is still a New York animal. It's the parakeet.
Okay.
But I've been visited by these other animals, and I have to admit, I'm very excited to hear that up by Port Huron they saw a wolverine. You know, I think that's great.
Yeah.
I think that's really great. It's really exciting. Mm-hmm. You know.
Well, I think your poems do a great service to Michigan, and I was glad to see, you know, every reference possible, you know, including in one of your older poems, you mentioned the sounds of a snowmobile. And I thought, oh my gosh, I bet most people out there don't know what a snowmobile sounds like, but, it, you know, for a Michigander, it's...
Yes, and the sound of a snowmobile is sort of like the sound of a tattooist gun writ loud.
Oh, okay. Well, you have something to compare it to that just put in context for those who've never heard of snowmobile. But of course, maybe some of them haven't heard a tattooist gun either. But anyway, the last question I'll get to is, your wife, Marianne Salmon, is also a poet. Isn't it challenging to have two writers, two poets living under the same roof?
Yeah.
Do you help one another with your writing?
We're very different writers,
okay.
And that's a good thing. I think if we were writing in similar veins, similar traditions, trying to publish in similar magazines, mm-hmm. I think we would we would have, you know, beat each other with oven mitts a long time ago. I am much more a disciple of Whitman, and she is much more a disciple of Dickinson, if you think of those two as the sort of great barriers, the end goals, end zones, right? The goalposts of American poetry. I'm much closer to the Whitman side of things and she's much closer to the Dickinson side of things. We do help each other sometimes with each other's poems, and one of the things I think we're probably best at is being able to say, this is something you do a lot. Mm-hmm. And sort of give, not criticism, or but just sort of an awareness, a hyper-awareness of, oh yeah, I do make a move similar to this, or I do use this word a lot, or this image a lot. The other thing is we go to see each other read often, and that forces us to sometimes pick different poems to read, which is probably a good thing, you know? I sort of sometimes feel doing readings like Keith Richards having to play Satisfaction one more time. I must admit that I really imagine backstage he and Mick and Charlie and I guess Bill Wyman's no longer with the band, but Ron Wood are sitting around like, do we have to play Satisfaction? Anything but that. You know, we keep each other honest, and that's a good thing.
Good. Well, thank you very much, Jerry, for participating in the Michigan Writers Series.
Thank you.
And good luck with
me.
Your reading tonight.